Welcome to the Better Clinician Podcast with myself, Ben Cormack, and also Adam Meekins. The Better Clinician Project brings you high-quality education at a ridiculously low price. This podcast will bring you topics that are relevant to modern clinical practice, all done with a bit of fun and humour. Nothing in this podcast constitutes medical advice.
All right, BC peers and those listening on the podcast who may not be BC peers, welcome to our first Thoughtful Thursday of 2024. So if you are new to the BCP or you're listening to the podcast for the first time, what me and Ben like to do every month is ask some questions to our BC peers, some hot topics of things that they would like us to discuss and talk about. And what we tend to do is have about half an hour conflating and discussing and debating, sometimes disagreeing around that. So, Ben, are you ready for the first Thoughtful Thursday of 2024?
I am. I was born ready, Mr. Meekins. I was born ready. This is actually helping my blood pressure. So this is a positive thing.
Yeah. Before Ben come on to record this, he's been having a very stressful time, but we won't go into that too much detail. But hopefully this will chill him out a little bit. So born, is Reddy your middle name then, is it?
It is. Reddy.
Reddy. Yeah. Do you want to know what my middle name is?
Frank.
Danger.
Danger. It's not. It's like Comrade or something, isn't it?
Comrade. It's Tarquin, actually.
Yeah, you know. Strike me as a bloody Tarquin.
All right, well, let's dive on into it then. Let's get on to our first question. And let's start off with the good old regular Bob Hessel. So Bob is one of our long-term BC peers. I'm not going to say he's one of our favourite BC peers because all our BC peers are favourite, but I like you. I think you're right, mate.
Has he got the Meekin seal of approval, has he?
He's got the definitely Meekin seal of approval. So Bob's a very smart, switched-on, intelligent cookie, and he likes to ask us some questions regularly on Thoughtful Thursday, and he's got a blinder for us this time. So he has said, what works in physiotherapy?
Oh, Jesus
Question
Christ.
Mark.
Blimey, Bob, you know, give some gentlemen a break here. You really hit us with the big questions, haven't you?
I think it's a good question. What does work in physiotherapy? And he goes on to expand a little bit more in his question, saying, you know, that myself and you and others out there, you know, we're quite critical. We tend to, you know, talk about things that have been seen to have lack of efficacy, don't seem to have big effect sizes. So we're often telling people about things that don't work, that don't seem to do much. So, you know, let's look at the other side of the coin. What can we turn around and say? What works in physiotherapy, Ben?
Well, blimey. So, look, I, it's not my first rodeo. I have heard similar questions before. And one of the problems is that therapists want big answers, right? We want to know what works. And the problem with science is it generally tackles small questions, doesn't it? So it wants to know, you know, we might ask the question of, you know, does a certain treatment work? What outcome measures does it work for? What condition does that in? You know, what population, etc. So we want big answers. And unfortunately, science often gives us quite small, discrete answers. So I think that's the first problem that we come across, don't we? Is when we say it works, what's the outcome measure? Is it pain? Is it disability? Is it quality of life? What's the problem that we're trying to solve? What's the population that we are also looking at? So again, it's a really, really big question, and it's something that we probably need to dissect a little bit.
Yeah, great point. As I said, a lot of people want to know what works for everybody all of the bloody time. That's the black and white approach. Yeah, exactly. That question is often asked. What works all of the time for everybody? And the simple answer is, as Ben said, nothing. So as Ben was alluding to there, what we got to do is make that question a bit more specific. We have to narrow it down. We have to add further things to it. So what works for what type of patient, for what type of conditions, in what sort of situations and scenarios? And that is then where we perhaps get a little bit more ability to answer things with a bit more certainty, but still not a lot more certainty, because there is a lot of uncertainty around this. Because again, the research often shows things work or don't work very generically, you know, looking at population sizes rather than individual sort of responses. And again, I know that's a criticism of a lot of randomized controlled trials that say, you know, this doesn't work. And people say, well, it can work for some people, but in this trial, the washout effect shows it hasn't worked for the population. So I think there's also that individual variation a lot of the time as well.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the big problems that we see, is that population research is population research. So the point of an RCT is to be able to take two groups and compare them, right? So you might take treatment versus no treatment, or you might take two different types of treatment, and then you're going to compare them and say, is there a difference between these two things in the population and for the specific outcome measure that we've identified? Now, the problem with that is you have to average the number. It has to be averaged, because otherwise how the fuck do you compare them, right? So the point of an RCT, you know, whether it's one arm or two arms, well, it has to be two arms, doesn't it? Not one arm or two arms. Whether it's two arms or three arms, is that we compare those averages, because you can't compare 200 people versus another 200 people. Otherwise you have to compare them all against each other at all the different times, and it becomes just an absolute mess, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So the basic fact here is that randomized control trials do a very, very good job at what they're designed to do, which is tell us, on average, when we compare these two things, you know, what difference do we see? But does that tell us what works for your patient? No. Does it give us a probability of what might work? I think yes. And I think that's, you know, at the moment, they do a wonderful job of a very bad, complicated situation. And I don't think at the moment we've got anything comparable or anything better.
No, as I said, a lot of the research that, you know, you look at for physiotherapy treatments, it often comes out with very small effect sizes and no significant difference in comparison to the comparator or to the sham. But that is, as Ben was saying, that doesn't mean automatically it doesn't work for the person in front of you. It's just that the research, as I say, is designed to try to answer the question in a certain way. You know, the thing that really does wind me up, though, with a lot of the research and the randomized control trials done in physiotherapy is when they compare it to usual care.
Right.
What,
yes.
What the fuck does usual care? There is no such thing as usual care in physio. The variation and the variety.
This is true.
Is astronomically huge. And so when I see research trials saying, I know the pragmatic design of it, I understand that approach, you know, but
it reflects reality.
But if you're going to use a pragmatic approach, then you've got to have a more pragmatic research design, and RCTs I think sometimes are not the best suitable way for doing that. So yeah, when I see these comparisons against usual care, I just want to pull my hair out most of the time.
Yeah. So if you were to really back me into a corner and ask me what makes the biggest difference to people's symptoms, you would have to say time. Yeah. And there were three or four trials recently. What would you call them? I don't know. They're looking at trying to disentangle natural history, regression to the mean, specific effects, contextual effects, etc. So they're not really, they're you know, analysis maybe. And there was one done by it's a bunch of Australian guys. There was one done by a British guy with a double-barreled name that I'm not going to even attempt to.
Well remembered the author's name here, Ben. Well done. Yeah, good point.
Yeah, well done. My brain is.
There was this guy that was had a name, that had a surname as well. I think he had a first name and a surname.
Yes, well, there is this, you know, I love this, that people think that if you can remember a researcher's first name, it makes you more intelligent. And that just annoys me.
That's a little trick that I have, actually. If you ever are in a conference or you're doing a presentation and you do want to sound intelligent, just drop a couple of papers with an author's name and a year. So, Louis Hoonabonk in 1997 first did this study in the Journal of Applied Sciences and Bioengineering, and he showed, and you know, you can just sound really intelligent a lot of the time, even though you may have just pulled it out your backside.
Exactly. So the memorization of the year and author of a piece of research is very unimpressive to me, but it seems to be impressive to a lot of other people, if I'm being honest. So, but there's been a number of different, I think, there was the Toby, the German guy. I think
I know who you mean. I can't remember. It begins with an S. His surname.
Yeah, Sorsreg or whatever it is.
I can't even pronounce it. Even if I could remember it, I couldn't pronounce it.
There you go. So there's about three or four papers recently have all shown that specific effects seem to be at around about 30%. Contextual effects seem to be at about 20%. And then the effect of time, regression, all of these other kind of, you know, things that have an effect, but we don't really, you know, have any control over at all. They seem to account for about 50% of the change that we see. Yeah. So if someone was to say to you, what has the biggest effect on what we observe clinically or in a research trial, it would be time every day of the week.
Yep. No, I'm in agreement, as well as the, what's his name? Philosopher Voltaire famously said, the art of good medicine, and I suppose we could put therapy in there as well under medicine, is amusing the patient whilst time or natural history cures the disease. And that's going back to what, 1800s, I think he was around when he came up with that.
Voltaire, mid 19th century, I think. I might have got that wrong, though. It might have been earlier than that, but you know.
It was a while ago. It wasn't last week. It was a good while ago, and it hasn't changed much since.
It wasn't Kapchuk 2015, let's put it like that.
No, exactly. So either way, we've known for a long while, like Voltaire says, time is the greatest healer. But I think, as Ben also said, you know, we can try to, we can help encourage the natural processes of time, you know, to go smoothly, to perhaps run that a little bit quicker, but perhaps maybe not significantly quicker, with, you know, the contextual effects, the reassurance effects, and all those sort of things that the therapeutic encounter can have.
So the question I always ask myself, let's say there's a pathology, there's a nociceptive source. How much do our physical treatments, whether that's manual therapy, whether it's ultrasound, whether it's exercise, whatever, how many of those treatments actually have an effect on the generation of nociception or the pathology itself? So I think a lot of things modulate that nociceptive signal, right? So we have descending stuff that goes on, and, you know, all these fabulous opioids and cannabinoids. But what of our treatments actually have an actual effect on the generation of nociception, or the kind of, if we have a recognizable pathology? And that's the question. Or are we just, as Louis Gifford said, are we just playing with processing?
Yep. Another great quote there as well. And I'm going to drop another one, the Archie Cochrane quote as well, that talks about, you know, not just therapies, interventions, but medicine in general. You know, trying to positively change human physiology is extremely fucking difficult. He didn't use the F word, by the way. I've just added that there. But Archie Cochrane said, changing human physiology is incredibly difficult. And if it does occur for the positive effects, one should be delightfully impressed and satisfied, because it doesn't often happen much. So it is something, as I say, that in physiotherapy, we seem to think we change, speed up healing processes, improve things. But that's just really not what's happening. As Ben was saying, we are playing with processing. We are modulating symptoms rather than actually changing the course of a pathology or a disease, I'm sure of it.
Yeah, and that change, you know, all these years ago, we thought we were, you know, with joints, we were, you know, even the kind of, you know, the famous, I think it was a Maitland study where they looked at thumb positioning after, you know, various glides and slides. And they're finding that they, you know, they just don't have we're not seeing these mechanical changes that we thought we were seeing. We're not seeing these, we're not really changing anything. But could you also say calming down nociception or calming down things, could that actually have a longer term positive effect? That's something that I do wonder. If we does modulation maybe reduce sensitization?
Great question. And there's some research trials there out there begging to be done to try and answer that, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So
right, okay, that's
is Adam just gonna be done with that one?
So yeah, I think you know, we've done that one to death, yeah.
Adam's done with that one.
I think so. I think we've gotten around and said, you know, what works in physio, and there's lots of things that work for certain people at certain times. And again, that's, I think, again, a misunderstanding of our critique of a lot of treatments and interventions that we do. I don't go around telling people you can't do bird dogs, all right? I don't tell people that, you know, the bird dog isn't to be used because it isn't seen to be superior in helping people with back pain compared to deadlifts. It's just that it's not superior. That's my argument. It is not the cure. It is not the fix. But it doesn't mean you can't still use bird dogs if you've got a patient who likes bird dogs, who wants to do the bird dogs.
The biggest problem with the bird dog is that it has this illusion of specificity.
Yeah. That could be the biggest problem. It could also be its biggest benefit. And I think that's a lot of these eggs.
It could. The illusion of benefit. Again, this comes back to contextual effects, doesn't it? Yeah. There's your 30%.
There was that paper that I haven't read it fully yet. I want to go through it. But it was talking about the patient's experiences of generic exercises versus specific exercises. And
Mitchell Gibb, I've read it actually.
Yeah, Mitchell Gibb was talking about, again, I've just read the abstract, but it looks like, as I say, patients generally do favour the illusion of specificity, which...
But why would you not?
Exactly right. Why would you not want to go and get something that you think is more individualized and specific to you rather than just a generic sheet of exercises that are just given to you haphazardly? Yeah, no, I get it.
Why would you not want something that appears to be thought out and specific for your problem?
Absolutely.
It just, you know, although a good analogy might be a very generic antibiotic could help lots of different conditions. Do you see what I'm saying? So actually, from that perspective, you know, we're quite happy to give penicillin for a number of different infections. So actually, in some ways, although we like the illusion of specificity, we were also a little bit okay with quite general medicines as well. Paracetamol, aspirin, ibuprofen. All of these are very generic medicines for a wide range of problems.
That's a great point. Don't you love how... contradictory us human beings are a lot of the time.
Is that it's a, you know, a lot of the medicines we take are very generic. They you know, they do, are they just modulators?
Absolutely.
Well, they are, aren't they? So I think that's a real key point. But, you know, to wrap that one up, I think that time is our best. There are some specific effects, but I would say they tend to be more modulatory than they tend to affect pathology per se. I still think your immune system is the best modulator of everything.
Make sure you work hard and keeping that immune system in tip-top condition. Absolutely, yeah. Right, let's move on to the next one then. So we've got a couple of people asking a similar question here. So we've got Vigiliano, who I think you know, Ben.
Yes.
He's another long-term BCP. And we've also got, I'm going to say it's Michelle. Rather than Michael, because there's no E in it. Sorry, Michelle, if I've absolutely abused your surname, I apologise. Jakubek.
Or Mikkel.
Yeah, Mikkel or Michelle, I think.
I think it's Mikkel. I'm pretty sure it's a Polish name I'm pretty sure anyway.
So both Mikkel and Vigiano are asking us around the use of the placebo effect in clinical practice. Is it okay? Is there a balance? Are there times where it's acceptable to use placebos in clinical practice? what your thoughts on that, Ben? What's your initial gut reaction to that?
I would say no. Would say if you are relying on an inconsistent, unknown effect from whatever you're doing, then you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, no, my initial gut reaction there as well is no, but there is nuance there and obviously a bit of further explanation around that. I think the first thing that I get a bit frustrated about is people talking about placebos and placebo effects.
Right.
So a lot of people say, I'm using a placebo effect. And I'm like, no, you're not, because an effect is an effect. It's not actually a thing. It's not a treatment. It's not something. It's not a tablet. It's not a whatever it is. It's not a physical entity. So the placebo effect is this phenomenon that occurs with all interventions in treatments and stuff that we do. It's this unknown effect that makes people feel better. But because it's an unknown effect, it's uncontrollable. We don't know much about it. It's unreliable in its size and who it does and who it doesn't affect. So, again, we can't really, although we can study it, we can't really control it. So I think the first thing is when people say, can I use a placebo effect in clinic? I'm like, it's there already. You've got absolutely no control over whether it's happening or not. It is something that's there. Now, when it comes to the gone.
Yeah, and also we have a nocebo effect. So we can have absolute the opposite effect as well. It's not, you know, placebo effects can turn into contextual effects, can be positive or negative.
Yeah, but as I said, they are uncontrollable. I mean, this whole thing around the nocebic effect of language, for example, I think this is a fascinating discussion about how we've got to be careful about choosing words, because some words, as I say, can have detrimental effects on some people. So my question is, yeah, that's absolutely true. But how do you know which patient is going to have a nocebic reaction to a word and which patient isn't going to have a nocebic reaction to the word? And the simple answer is you don't until you've done it.
Well, I mean, even then, how do you quantify that? But I do think we may have to play a game of probabilities to some degree. I totally agree with you. However,
that's a first.
There you go. Happy birthday. so, you know, I do think that there potentially are words that are more probable to be problematic. And there may be words that are less probable to be
I get this, and I'm of the same school of thought. So because there is this risk, this chance of this word being perceived incorrectly, inaccurately, causing some harm, let's just avoid it anyway. But that's not automatically to say that word would automatically have nocebic effects on the person in front of you at that particular time. But erring on the side of caution, do no harm, which is a good analogy, it's not an analogy, it's a good mantra to have in healthcare, means, you know, why take the risk? Why use the word when it could potentially be misconstrued? So just don't bother. Absolutely get that. But if we flip the coin and use now that same thing with placebo, we're going to have some problems, because we're just going to not know who is going to get a good, strong placebo effect from our treatments or interventions.
No, so look, if I go in there as a nice person, I listen, I try and be as, you know, kind and as understanding and as focused as possible, I would like to think my probability of getting some good contextual effects is higher than if I didn't.
Yeah, but that's not a placebo effect. Contextual, again, this is another frustration I have. People mix up contextual effects with placebo effects. We understand contextual effects. We've studied contextual effects.
Yes, we've looked into, so
we know that, you know, being a kind, empathetic, warm human being, basically not being a knobhead, has a positive effect on people feeling that their treatments, their interventions are better. So absolutely, contextual effects, fucking go to town, use that. Right. Great. That's not being unethical.
I understand your position.
Yeah. Yes. It's this argument about using a placebo effect. Because the first question is, what do you mean? What are you using when you say you're using a placebo effect? Because it's not a thing.
Right.
Yeah. So, and again, this whole thing is that it's unreliable as to who it's going to work on. I, being a critical, skeptical, grumpy shit, I can guarantee I probably would get no placebo effect from any or very minimal placebo effect from any treatments or interventions, because I doubt and I'm critical and I'm skeptical of anything, even fucking genuine medicines that's been proven to help me. I'm like, this is not doing fucking much bloody good at all. I've got a raging fucking infection. I'm taking my antibiotics and going, this is a load of fucking shit. It's not even fucking working. Yeah. So if I was to get a... And I'm sure, again, you know, there's loads of people out there like me as well who have this very skeptical, critical view about anything. And so, you know, the placebo effects in these people are going to be a little bit less. And then obviously the more open-minded, I'm not going to use the word gullible, but they often are gullible individual, is probably going to get a lot stronger unknown placebo effects from treatments and interventions, thinking their chakras are being realigned and their auras are being massaged.
Yeah, look, so that's a fair point. So if we are going to strictly define placebo effects as kind of a little bit more mysterious and black box, and then we might define contextual effects as things that we find more probable that might give us some positivity or negativity within our treatment, then I think that, you know, even to use the word placebo to some degree just screams, I don't know what the fuck is going to happen.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what's going to happen, don't do it.
No. And then the other argument then is, okay, well, let's move away from talking about the placebo effect. Let's talk about a physical placebo. Should we use something that we know is inert, that has no active treatment effect? Should we be actually using that in a treatment setting, a clinical setting, when we know it's not doing anything and therefore it's not really creating any positive benefit for the patient, other than we are deceiving them, we are giving them some misdirection, we are telling them something else about what we are doing to them when we're actually not doing it? For me, when we start to talk about that in clinical settings, that becomes unethical and also immoral. And I don't think, you know, if you are using placebos, which I don't think you should be, you certainly shouldn't be fucking making a profit off them and treating people for it from a financial point of view either.
Yeah, well, I suppose...
If you want to use a placebo... Sorry to interrupt you, mate. I'm getting on a bit of a rant here.
No way!
if you want to use a placebo, okay, then I think to do it clinically, you have to do it open label. Right. You then have to go and say to the patient, I'm going to be doing this treatment. I'm going to give you this thing, this placebo... But it is a placebo. It's not actually going to create any treatment effect. It's not going to do anything to change your physiology. But I'm going to ask you to do this, or I'm going to do this to you because I believe it's beneficial for you. And then I'll say, if you're telling a patient that, I would like to see what that patient responds back to you. And they'll be like, am I paying 50 quid for this? Why are you giving me something that doesn't actually help me or has not actually got any active treatment effect, and you're now expecting me to pay 50 quid for this? I bet most patients wouldn't be happy about that.
No, well, if you walked into the pharmacy and they went under the counter and pulled out these tablets and said, we've got these tablets, they might work or they might not. What would you say?
Get fucked.
Exactly. We've got these tablets. They could be absolutely the best thing ever.
Yeah.
It depends on this amazing thing called the placebo effect.
Yeah.
Or they could be totally ineffective and they don't work at all. What would you say?
That's a great scenario to put it into context. Yeah, absolutely. You wouldn't be happy getting a placebo medication for your flu, your cold, whatever it is that you've got, you know, even if we know it's got no life-threatening issues, it's got a favorable natural history. Yeah, you wouldn't be happy going to get placebo strepsils or placebo paracetamol, particularly if you're paying for them.
Just grab me a pack of those placebo strepsils, please. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, so at the end of the day, I think that if you do get a placebo effect, it's a happy accident, isn't it? It's a positive thing that's happened, isn't it? It's a happy bonus, not a happy accident. There you go.
Yeah,
or it's an accidental bonus, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
It's not a treatment strategy.
No.
It's not a treatment strategy. Now, some things may have effects wrapped up in them that we can never disentangle.
Yeah.
You know, and we could say surgery, etc.
Say exercise.
Yeah, you could say exercise, but I also think there probably is at least a pain modulatory effect from lots of the treatments that we do that would probably be in some way physiological through just movement. So exercise probably has that. Manual therapy probably has that. You know, when we start to get into things like acupuncture, I don't understand the mechanism that's there, if that makes sense. You know, that becomes a little bit more shrouded in mystery, doesn't it? And I think that, therefore, you know, what I would like to see is some basic research and just some basic scientific plausibility. Anything else that I get is a happy coincidence and I'm going to take it, but I'm certainly not going to rely on it in lieu of some decent research and some basic physiological, you know, plausibility.
Yep, I'm in agreement there, mate, as well. All right, so I think we can wrap up placebos in clinical practice and say, yeah, if you're going to use them, be open and honest about it. If you've got something that you know doesn't outperform placebo effects, cupping, acupuncture, and you want to use it, then perhaps you need to be, as I say, a bit more open and honest to your patients and say, this hasn't been seen to be any more effective than a placebo. Are you happy for me to carry on using it? And were you quite happy for me to carry on charging for it? And if the patient turns around and says, yes, please, thank you, I get good effects from it, great. You've been open, honest, you've been integral, you've been, you know, moral, and you're cracking on with the patient's, you know, permission. Great. But if the patient turns around to you and say, well, I never knew it didn't outperform placebo. What do you mean it's only a placebo effect? I don't want it now. I want to do something else then. Great. Okay. Now you're going to have to change tact. So that would be my approach. Talk to patients about things that we know don't outperform placebos. Be open and honest about it if you're going to use them and see what the patient's informed choices are based on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Good. I like it. Should we do one more?
Have we got time and energy to finish off with,
yeah,
mate?
I think we can do one more. Let's go with Tara. So I think Tara's an Australian, but we won't hold it against her. although I do love my Australian brothers and sisters and wombats and barbecues and that kind of stuff. So she is talking about inflammation. Now, inflammation seems to be a really, really...
That's a bad word.
Is that right? Is inflammation
apparently,
a bad word?
Apparently, oh, I read somewhere that it's a dangerous word. It has nocebic connotations, apparently.
Oh,
you can't you can't tell patients they've got inflammation.
No, really?
No, that's what this paper said. I disagree with it completely, but it's a physiological process that happens a lot of the time. So why you can't bloody explain it and talk it about it? Perhaps I think it's the way it's framed, I think, to patients, maybe.
There is an argument to say all pain is inflammatory to some degree.
Yeah, if you want to get into your pain geeky science, which I know you bloody love to get into at the moment, okay, you could say there is emerging evidence now that chronic pain is perhaps due to some low-grade inflammatory effects. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you could go further than that. I read a paper the other day that was just saying, you know, its very essence and core, the process of pain is one of sensitization driven by chemical mediators, you know, so...
Neuroimmunoinflammatory responses or whatever it is,
well,
I don't know. But
that is pain to something. Yeah. So I think what's changed now is that we're looking at inflammation and we're understanding that there are more types than just, say, prostaglandin or cyclooxygenase mediated.
I knew you'd love to throw a few at these.
Yeah, fuck it, why not? But, you know, what we may see as traditional inflammatory pathways mediated by, say, damage maybe are not as prevalent as we first thought, but are there a whole bunch of other, you know, neuro-driven inflammatories, low-grade systemic inflammatories, you know, all these other type of things going on that we don't know as much about. But as much as people like to bang on about them, it's brilliant from a knowledge standpoint, but actually we might as well pack up and get another job, because what the hell do you do about it, you know?
Well, that's moving on to Tara's question. What can we do with people that do have inflammations, as particularly, you know, if they're trying to move away from pharmacological treatments of it and the use of non-steroidals, which we know do have some harms against them, which often get downplayed, by the way. I find you know, inflammation does have a bad rap in particularly musculoskeletal healthcare. It's often seen to be the bad guy. And in acute injuries and post-surgical and trauma and stuff like that, inflammation needs to be celebrated. It needs to be, yeah, needs to be encouraged, needs to be explained that it's a really beneficial process to go through.
But that was the point of so much. When I went to university, it was about reducing inflammation, reducing swelling. You know, we want to calm these processes down. Whereas maybe now we're realizing, A, we may not be able to calm them down, calming them down may be actually problematic in some standpoints.
Don't get in the way of the body's natural healing processes.
Although I think one of the problems now is maybe this is, and this is where it leads us maybe back into the biopsychosocial world, is that, you know, it does help us understand that sleep, lifestyle, health, all of these things might be much, much more important than pathology.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I was going to say. Rather than reaching for the anti-inflammatories to control inflammation that may be, you know, maladaptive, it may be not useful. They've gone through the acute phases. You know, before you start looking for pharmacological ways to dampen and suppress inflammation, why not look at your own natural ways to suppress and reduce inflammation? Why not, as you say, go to bed a bit earlier, try and improve your sleep, try and improve your diet, try and exercise a bit more. All of these things are seen.
Don't smoke so much.
Exactly. All of these things are great ways to reduce your systemic inflammatory profiles. The problem is it just takes a while for it to do that. And I think that's the problem. It's not a quick dampening effect. It takes weeks, if not months, of consistency to actually have these effects, which a lot of people don't want the time or the energy or the effort to actually do.
And I think there's also probably, you know, especially with, let's say, chronic back pain, we know about 25-30% of chronic back pain goes on to be chronic. It might be that the source of pain or one of the major influences of pain is autoimmune in these people. It could be that it's not structural, it's not lifestyle, it's not genetic or whatever. It could be, some kind of epigenetic, maladaptive, you know, autoimmune process that's occurring. And at the moment, I just don't think we have an answer for that. But what I don't like, the big argument we're having at the moment, is it seems to be about proving whether we are right or wrong, rather than actually saying, how do we help these people with this problem? And I think that's the bit that I struggle with a little bit, even if it does turn out to be something that we haven't identified or we can't do anything about right now. You know, how do we factor that into what we are doing and how we're helping? I think that, for me, is the conversation, not whether you can identify it on imaging or not identify it, or, you know, these type of things.
Yeah, well, some people just like to be right. They like to, and they like to.
That's called Twitter, by the way.
Yeah, and they also like other people to know that they're right and correct as well. And yeah, that's just usual egos and egotisticalness kicking in there. But yeah, all good points, mate. I think, as I say, inflammation is, you know, not always the bad guy. It can be, you know, problematic in certain situations. And there are lots of ways other than pharmacology to manage it and treat it. I think that's the summary I come up with.
And it's just too much of a general terminology. In the same way, nociception is too much of a general terminology. There are so many inflammatory pathways in our body mediated by a million and one different things. You know, some interleukins are pro and anti-inflammatory all at the same time. And we all label it as inflammation, whereas actually starting to determine, is it neurogenic or neuropeptide? Is it, you know, immune-driven? Is it, you know, classical-driven? These things really need to be delineated. Just saying the word inflammation just is a really crap catch-all. Not saying that about Atara, by the way. Just it's generally used as a really big word. But it's a bit like, does it work?
Right. Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. There's obviously all these subcategories of inflammation. Yeah, but You know, that's well above my pay grade and level of understanding and reading. I think what I like to try and determine at a very simplistic level, because I am a simplistic person at heart, is inflammation positive for this person in this situation or not positive, negative in this situation?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And that really fits in with their history of trauma or no trauma. Is it acute or is it chronic in time factors? And that pretty much, you know, puts it down to that simplistic level of my understanding around inflammation, really.
Yeah.
And I'm quite happy with that level of inflammation going into level of understanding.
Level of information about inflammation.
Information. That's what I was trying to say. The level of information on inflammation. There's a tongue twister to try and finish on.
Try saying that after a psychoxylogenase episode.
I don't even know what a psychoxylogenase is. All right. Well, hopefully that's been useful to you BCPers and also to those of you listening on the podcast. As I say, we like to put these Thoughtful Thursdays out on a monthly podcast as well to our non-BCP audience. So we hope you're enjoying these podcasts. If you do enjoy the podcasts and you want to dive on a little bit more into myself and Ben's teachings and musings around musculoskeletal pathologies, then come on in and join the BCP, join the community, the ever-growing community. And say it'll only cost you £12 a month. There is no contracts or commitments. You don't have to stay more than 1 month if you don't want to. You get full access to the back catalogue of over 4 years' worth of hard work and dedication that myself and Mr. Cormack have done. And you get access... Yeah, but there is a lot of good quality info in there. Even if I do say so myself, we've gone through, must be over 100 pathologies now over the years where we break it down, look into, you know, the evidence, the research. We look at some ways of treating it, giving some rehab ideas. And as I say, there's always our guest interviews as well. If you want a third voice that's different from these London accents of mine and Ben, and you want somebody with a bit more intelligence to listen to as well, we've got loads of guests on as well for you to listen to. So come join the BCP at thebetterclinicianproject.com.
I just wanted to add, we've done 100 pathologies and piriformis syndrome.
Yeah, we've either had to go down that pathway to talk about things that are considered to be pathologies, but technically aren't. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just teasing anyone out there who's heavily invested in piriformis syndrome.
We've also done subacromial impingement as well, which really isn't a thing either as well.
Mate, we could say actually we've done 2 pathologies and 98 other things that we talked
about. Made up things, scapular dyskinesis.
Femoral pain. Yeah. Exactly. There we go. Good stuff. Well, we
look forward
to seeing everyone next week.
Thank you for listening to the BCP podcast. If you would like to check out the BCP, please go to www.betterclinicianproject.com. There we have literally hundreds of videos on clinical topics, exercise examples for rehabilitation and research reviews, alongside features such as Thoughtful Thursday. And please tune in again.